Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversation on the exchange, feel free. Jump in at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. There are lots of how-to books out there dealing with relationships, love, and marriage. Today's guest presents less of a how-to than a how-I-did. Cindy Shupak shares the details of her own search and discovery in the book The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. Cindy Shupak has a long resume in TV writing and producing, including Sex and the City and Modern Family. She's written about dating and relationships for the likes of Glamour and Oh, the Oprah magazine, and is the author of her previous book, a bestseller, The Between Boyfriends book. Cindy Shupak with The Longest Date, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You obviously have a sense of humor. How much was that challenged by the years of living single?
There was actually so much material living single that it was definitely challenged, but it was such a nice consolation when you were on a bad date to know it was going to be good material that I think it helped. It's a little less that way in marriage because it's, you know, the date continues.
Right. It goes on and on for sure. So I have to ask, do comedy writers have funny lives or fairly disastrous lives that they find ways to make funny in the retelling?
I can't speak for all comedy writers, but I think a disastrous life is often the case. It depends how you look at it, right? Because a disastrous life can be funny. It's just tragedy plus time, right? I do like how you characterize the book, though, as micro rather than macro, because that's really how I like to write. And maybe it seems egotistical to think the world should care about my story, but I feel really much more comfortable just saying, here's my experience. I hope and I think you'll relate to it and laugh and relate your own experiences to it rather than saying, here's what you do for a happy marriage or here's what you're going to encounter. It's hard for me to tell people what I think they should do.
You can't exactly cast yourself in the Dr. Phil chair here and
say,
well, here's what you need to do.
No, here's just what I did wrong. Maybe you will.
you start off by, this is a quote here, the honest, horrible, hysterical truth about the early years of marriage. Horrible? Really?
Well, just what you discover about, what I discovered about myself. I was really, you know, as much as I wanted to find the one and I was writing about looking for the one for so long, once I did find the one, I had a lot of growing to do as far as actually making room for him in my life and in my house and adjusting to the real of marriage, I guess.
I'm trying to figure out the timing here. The Between Boyfriends book then would have actually been published about the time you and Ian were making your relationship solid, wouldn't it?
What happened was it was published right when I met him. It had just come out. I had just finished my book tour, which I wrote about for the New York Times Book Review. I wrote the Between Boyfriends tour, and it's on my website, cindyshupak.com, and it was kind of the fantasy that I was going to meet the man I would marry on my book tour, crashing against the hordes of women who were coming to hear me talk about my book and ask about Sex and the City. And so I had sort of given up on that. And then I met Ian, and I was so excited to have written a book that I gave him my Between Boyfriends book, and he said, never do that again with any guy you're interested in, because it basically chronicles every mistake I ever made dating and everyone I ever dated. So, yeah, it was right around when I had finished the book tour, given up, and was just, you know, excited to have written the book that I met him.
Which is, I think, the way life works. It's like just when you stop looking, suddenly somebody comes along.
It does, yeah. I think that is true. I mean, I hate to say, again, you never know, but that does seem to be the case, that when you're just kind of living your life and doing what is true to you and following your own heart, that somebody comes along.
Well, it's funny you should mention that Ian said, don't ever do that again.
Yeah, he was pretty sure he wasn't the one, and I was pretty sure he wasn't the one. He was just giving me advice for future relationships.
but then now you've reached this point where you feel like your marriage is resilient enough that he'll put up with having himself put out there, you know, because he's the story or half the story anyway.
Yeah, he's been a very good sport about it. That is a difficult thing about, I mean, it's probably why not as many people write about marriage, because you are involving another person. You're telling their story, and they have to be game for it and open and, you know, willing to be exposed. And because I was honest, but I always ran everything by Ian, and he is a good sport, and he appreciates my writing. I say he's been a fan, and he likes the things that are honest, and, you know, he's a good storyteller himself, so it was a good combination.
Did he watch Sex and the City? I mean, I'm just curious to know if he had been aware of your work, even though not by name, maybe.
Yeah, no, when we first met, which was at the Moth, a storytelling event, I don't know if that's hit your area, but there's a lot of storytelling happening in New York and L.A. now, just kind of spoken word and not, it sounds so uppity, storytelling, but all it is really is just kind of the next iteration of stand-up, I think, where it's really true stories told by the person they happen to and hopefully funny, but sometimes poignant. We met through an event like that, and afterward, when he found out I worked on Sex and the City, he said he always watched with his friends in his apartment in the East Village, and that he was a big fan, and he was really into it, although he did mention that it put a bit of pressure on him, he felt, because if things went wrong, you know, when we finally slept together, he said if it was bad, you know, he might tell a few friends, I might tell the entire world.
That would make somebody a little reluctant, perhaps, in the early going, yes.
He has a big ego, so he overcame it.
So you do make us wait a few chapters, Cindy, but Ian is not your first husband. What happened with number one?
Yeah, that that is a hard thing to just gloss over, I've been realizing, on this book tour.
Yeah, it's like chapter 3 or 4 or something.
I tried to slip it in there. Yeah, I was married when I was in my early 20s to a guy who realized he was gay. But that's not what we're talking about. It's kind of a hard thing to just smooth over. But I outline it. It was, you know, it was no different than any marriage that failed. Maybe a little easier because there was nothing I could do to fix that.
Right, yeah. It couldn't be, yeah, it's me, not you. It's just, you know,
yeah.
Right, one of those. Much more to talk about with Cindy Shupack. Her book is The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. You can join us, perhaps with some stories about your own relationships here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange with Cindy Shupack and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, Cindy Shupack, comic, comedy writer, has worked on Sex and the City and Modern Family, among others. She's out with a new book called The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. Cindy's been successfully married for several years now and is happy to tell the world about it. It's a micro, not a macro, as we pointed out. Not a how-to book, but a how-I-did book. And you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange, perhaps with some relationship foibles of your own. 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Honesty is kind of a hallmark of your writing, isn't it? You're really kind of come forth with everything here, including, ouch, an apology to the person Ian arrived with the night you met him.
Yes. Yeah, I found out later he had come to this event I met him at with a date, and she had left early because she had work the next day. And, you know, with a guy like Ian, that's the risk you take. I'm not sure if she was the one who made a mistake by leaving or I was the one who made a mistake by staying. We'll see, but that was definitely, I don't know, there were so many red flags about Ian early on. He was such a bad boy. I have a chapter on, oh, how we love bad boys, and he had motorcycle tattoos. He told me he'd break my heart. He wasn't looking for a relationship. He wasn't sure if he believed in monogamy. I mean, he just threw up every red flag in the book, and I kind of took him at his word and thought I would just keep looking, and then he just happily surprised me and continues to kind of happily surprise me. So maybe low expectations is the key. I'm not sure.
It's just like, well, whatever. Or looking past. It's sort of like the sense of looking for the real Messiah, isn't it, for both of you?
Yeah, I think... Yes, I think we... Well, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, in the sense that you're still waiting for the one.
Yeah.
Looking past the person you're actually with in the moment.
Yes, you're right. I mean, he wasn't looking for the one. He was looking for the, you know, several thousand.
Or 5 or 6. Oh, okay.
He was looking for as many as possible. And I was looking for the one. And, yeah, I thought I would keep looking. And, yeah, and then it kind of just snuck up on me. And I think for him it was my acceptance that just taking him at his word that took him by surprise. I think he was used to women saying, yeah, 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 and then thinking they were going to change him or convert him or win him over. And I was like, I don't have time for that. So there, I think it surprised him. I was willing to walk away or let it go at that and enticed him a bit.
So Ian did end a bit of a drought for you, but there was what self-imposed rule left you celibate for 9 months?
Well,
and isn't 9 months an interesting number?
Yes. I know, given our baby quest. You know, I wrote in the book, I was somewhere between a slump and a decision. It had been 9 months of just a drought for me where there was nobody, there was nothing happening in my love life, and I felt like I needed to end it with just someone, or I needed to make it mean something and wait the next time I slept with someone, it would be someone I was in love with. And then I met Ian, and I sort of fell off the wagon and realized I hadn't waited like I said I was going to. You know, wait, and then I ended up falling in love with him. But I do talk a little bit about kind of romantic semantics in the book, that once I started looking at not as a slump, but as a decision to wait till somebody meaningful, you know, I felt much more empowered and kind of a renewed energy. So I think sometimes you just reframe your situation. That was the impetus for Between Boyfriends, as opposed to calling yourself single, calling yourself Between Boyfriends. It's like, I'm not unemployed, I'm between jobs, I'm not single, I'm between boyfriends.
Romantic semantics, now it all makes sense, yes. So the issue with Ian, though, when the two of you were faced with each other then, I mean, how am I putting this? I mentioned the fact that you spent a little time looking past each other as if there were other people who were going to come along.
Uh-huh.
I think I've lost my train of thought entirely. Let me switch to a different question. had you not divorced husband number one by the time Ian came along?
No, I was divorced, long divorced. Mm-hmm. I married in my early 20s, and then I had like a decade of dating that became really the basis of my writing for Sex and the City, and I became kind of a... I'm not an expert, because I think really there shouldn't be such thing as a dating expert, because if you're doing it long enough to become an expert, then you probably are doing something wrong.
Because you can't get in a permanent relationship?
Yes. So I don't know what that was, but I did it long enough where I had a lot of stories. Let's just say that. And by the time I met Ian, even writing this book, it almost feels like I forgot I was married before. I felt like I was learning it all over again. I was such a different person by then. I was so independent that the challenges really became the fact that I had figured out who I was and was so independent, and so was he, you know, at a later age. So then you really have the challenges of combining two fully formed lives and all the conflicts that come up when you're trying to merge your life with someone.
As opposed to the people who are not fully formed and do form relationships that can go on a long time, but you're really discovering a lot about yourself in addition to the other person along the way.
Yeah, then I think there's this element of just growing. Hopefully you're growing compatibly. And some couples do marry right out of high school and have wonderful relationships, and they just manage to keep growing in a similar way. But I think, you know, also there's a number of people who marry in their early 20s who grow and apart and realize they weren't quite, you know, compatible as they got older.
When you meet the friends who got married a lot younger, though, when they perhaps were not fully formed and yet have managed to stay together, I mean, does it sound like a very different kind of marriage to what you're experiencing with Ian?
Hard to know. I mean, what I do feel like a lot of our conflicts came out of that, and even our struggles of trying to have a baby came out of the fact that we were older. And in addition, we both are good at asking for and kind of demanding what we need, so compromise is a little bit more difficult, I think, because you can dig in a little bit more. You're used to really living your life as you want. So I think people who marry younger, and again, I hate to generalize anything. I mean, maybe we can hear from some of your listeners who did. Maybe you kind of grow up learning to think as a team, and it might help, you know, in the same way that I invited Ian in. He came to live with me in the house I had bought myself, and there was a bit of an adjustment because it was really my space he was moving into. I think couples who get a space together, that's probably better in a way because they can grow together. They both feel equal ownership. And
not my house, not your house, our house, yeah.
Yeah, so I think maybe that's a metaphor for how a marriage works when you marry younger. You kind of create your house together.
Let's hear from listeners about your own experiences. Did you marry young? Did you marry old? How successful have your relationships been? And how does it compare with the stuff you're hearing about here from Cindy Shupak? The Longest Date is her book, Life as a Wife. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jeannie in Medford, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, good morning. Jeffrey, I always know it's going to be a good show when you get that certain laugh.
Oh, the giggle comes up, doesn't it?
Yeah. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
I'm sorry, I never watched TV to see those shows, but I heard they were great, Sex and the City. And you know, the honeymoon's over when she's sitting on the toilet with a magazine while he's brushing his teeth.
Or shaving. I've heard variations of that myself.
Oh, yeah, okay. And I have a sort of a medical question. The seven-year itch, that the chemical in the brain when we're in love is just like a natural high. I know I felt it, mm-hmm. and like an addiction anyway, after so many husbands. And then you find the right one, as you did. But and they say if the medical so-called experts, if you stay past that hump of 7 years after that drug in the brain wears off, then you really make it, and you get even a better love and high.
All right.
I hope that made sense.
Yeah, let's pursue that one, Jeannie. And you didn't actually talk to a lot of psychologists or anything for this book, did you, Cindy?
I didn't. I don't do that kind of research, mm-hmm. you know, for better or worse. Although I do read a lot, and yeah, I'm interested in those same sorts of theories. I'm going on year 8, so I can attest that we got past the 7-year itch. And I think the thing to remember is there's these ebbs and flows, so not to panic when you are in a period where you're not feeling that spark in your brain and you feel like it's gone. I have friends who've been married a lot longer than I have that said they have had, you know, like an amazing year 13 for some reason, like the sex was amazing all of a sudden again. And, you know, so you just to know that there can be highs and lows in your, you know, hormones about each other. And I think it's hard to separate what you're going through emotionally or career-wise or, you know, our baby quest. All that affects this, or you have a new baby. That affects things. So there's what I think is, as time goes on and you go through these struggles and you get through things together as a team, it just makes you stronger so that there's more than just that spark and chemistry. There's just a whole mentality.
It's more than just romance.
Yeah.
It is that too, but you got the other things rolled in there as well. Given the fact that you and Ian did meet a little later in life and then were fully formed individuals, as you put it then, I mean, did that also help in the sense that you can realize that each person is going to have some ups and down times and not going to be pulling necessarily the 50%, but maybe down around 43 or less at times?
Yeah, though we still struggle with that. And I hate to keep using the term fully formed like other people were not, because, I mean, I'm still...
Yeah, I realize how people could take that the wrong way.
Yes. but, you know, I don't know if that's what's so funny to me about how blindsided I was by some of these struggles. I was very good at managing my own life, and he was good at managing his, but we still are sometimes surprised what it takes to compromise or find some, you know, middle ground. And so I don't know. It's still a struggle. We should understand all that much better. You know, we should understand how you need to compromise. But I think you're kind of worse at it because you're older and you haven't had to compromise so much. So.
Right. You hadn't gotten in your way for a long time. Sure.
Yeah.
The vows in the third chapter of the book, The Vows I Read at Our Wedding, is the title of the chapter. As if that wasn't public enough, is the subtitle. Are these actually the vows?
Yes, those were the vows I read at our wedding, which maybe seems odd to include in the book, but I wanted to just, I thought they drew such a picture of how, what we were at the time. I mean, I was a writer at the time, and Ian wrote some amazing vows too, and they were quite long, and we read them publicly, and I preface it by saying I was at a wedding years earlier where the couple read their vows, and it just made me realize, even though that might be hokey, even though that might be a part of a wedding that you hate the most when a couple reads their vows, or maybe it's your favorite part, but to me, it kind of struck me what that meant to be able to say out loud in front of your closest friends and family how you feel about this person, why you love this person. And I started using that as a test of people I was dating. Like, could I really stand up in front of everyone who knows me so well and say honestly how excited I am to spend my life with this person and why I love them? And so because I had so much to say about Ian, I was very happy I had so much to say. And it was kind of a funny and poignant little piece I wanted to write for why I was marrying him.
You did have a lot to say, and that was one of the things that struck me. And this is not the Gettysburg Address. This is fairly lengthy stuff that obviously went on for a few minutes.
And apparently our wedding planner was panicking because the catering was being held.
So two questions then. It's, you know, like any writer, you're going to edit yourself, so there's probably a lot you actually left out. of that. And so I was just wondering if there was a lot. And the other one is the emotions that come with the moment. When you're saying these things, it's really hard to hold it together sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It was a really joyful wedding. We really made it our own. I mean, that was one of the benefits of having it be a second wedding for me, was that, you know, we had cocktails before. I was with the guests before. We were in a big loft. We moved everyone in and had the ceremony. A lot of people were standing around us, and then we, you know, moved in and had the dinner and dancing. And it was just a big party where we happened to get married. So and we played songs we loved in our, you know, bridesmaids. Our bridal posse, as we called them, friends came kind of dancing in. So it was a pretty fun and joyful, irreverent, non-traditional wedding. I was wearing a green dress, and Ian was wearing this crazy paisley jacket that was like, so it wasn't anything you'd expect, really.
Oh, no pictures of this either, darn it.
Yeah, there were some pictures of it in style. Yeah, I didn't post any pictures of that.
All right. True or false, Ian found the rabbi hot.
True.
And you thought that was okay.
I was relieved because she was hot, and she was a she, and I thought that was a good sign this time around.
Back to the chapter that you mentioned earlier, the Oh How We Love Bad Boys. We just get back to question one there, which is why? Why do we often like the people who are semi-dangerous, not just to the world at large, but to us and our feelings?
Dr. Phil? Probably an anthropological reason that, like, maybe they would seem like the better hunters because they're constantly on the hunt for women. So let's say that. They seem very capable of getting what they need. But, you know, I don't know. It would be funny to hear what your listeners say. There is an allure. It's been in films since James Dean. You know, there's something about that smoldering, hard-to-get guy who's elusive and hard to pin down, that when he does set his sights on you, it feels like you're special, you know, until he sets his sights on someone else. So if he asks you to marry him, you do feel special. And as I wrote in that piece, you just hire a very old nanny.
Somebody who's not hot.
Exactly. In other words. I did write in the book, and it's true. I had all sorts of dreams when I first married Ian about him cheating on me, and just all these. He was so horrible in my dreams. I started to call him Evil Ian, and I would wake up so mad and so betrayed. And he finally said, "This is completely not fair. I've been a perfect husband. I've been completely faithful, and that guy in your dreams is having all the fun, and I'm getting in trouble for it in the morning." So those dreams subsided, but there was definitely something in my psyche that was worried that I made a mistake marrying a bad boy.
So how did you let him know you were mad? I mean, did he get the silent treatment, or did you tell him right off you were mad?
You know, sometimes when you have a really disturbing dream, you really wake up with all the emotions, and I, you know, he would be making out with someone right in front of me, or just leaving without. I mean, he just was everything you might fear, and nothing what he really was in life. And I would just wake up disturbed, and I wouldn't, you know, directly get mad at him, but I would tell him what I dreamed, and as I was telling him, it would be disturbing, and he was kind of disturbed that I was thinking these things about him in my dreams subconsciously, that he was doing all these horrible things to me when he had clearly just been loving and a good husband. So it was just something that we had to get over. I mean, that my subconscious had to get over.
So there's a chapter in here on in sickness and in health, and you point out that one person is often at least a little more nurturing than the other. So which of you is that in this relationship?
Yes, to my great surprise, Ian is hugely more nurturing than me. He kind of loves the challenge of when I'm sick, and he brings me food, and he got this bell for me to ring for service as kind of a joke, but, you know, he'll respond to it. Meanwhile, it turns out when Ian has a cold, and it's not even that he milks it, and it's not a man cold, and it's not me making fun of how men are when they're sick, which is something I've read before. It was really me realizing I just do not enjoy seeing him in that weakened, compromised state, and I do not enjoy nurturing, and I think I have a real work ethic that is like, just pull yourself up and get back to work, because I barely ever get sick. And it was just sort of an odd thing I realized about myself, as I called it, my bitchy inner nurse.
I have to, on behalf of my gender, come back to the term you just used, man cold.
Yes. I learned that from a friend of mine, Anna Linda Thomas, who runs the site Ha-Ha's for Hoo-Ha's. But I don't know if she created that term. Probably not. It's probably been around. But that, yeah, it's a funny term. And I think a lot of women relate to that. And I will say men, sometimes can milk those, you know, it's like the world stops when they're sick. But at least for Ian, I do not stop when he's sick, and it's been a little bit hard for him.
All right, so men tend to be a little more wimpy about their colds.
Yeah, a little more dramatic. It's more the, you know, everything has to come to a halt, and they need care and nurturing. That's what I've heard from other women. I don't know. I don't indulge that.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember Sucrette's commercial from many years ago. It's my least favorite commercial of all time, and it's this guy shaking his wife awake. Barbara, you up? I feel awful. And she says, fine, I'll get the aspirin and Sucrettes. And he practically criticizes her for thinking of aspirin and Sucrettes when he's the one who woke her up. Just thought I'd share that. Longest date.
That you took her side.
Right. Exactly. The Longest Date, Life as a Wife is the book. Cindy Shupak, the author. We'll come back and talk more with Cindy about her relationship success that she writes about in this book. And we can compare some notes with you. Join us to tell some stories about keys to your relationship success. Or failure, for that matter. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on The Exchange with Cindy Shupak and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Cindy Shupak, who made a name for herself writing TV shows, including Sex and the City and Modern Family, currently still airing on ABC, always the top comedy out there. She's also written the Between Boyfriends book and followed that up with one called The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. She's been successfully married for several years now and shares that story with us. And you can share your story with us as well at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about which partner is the more nurturing one when somebody's sick, and it tends to be Ian, you were saying. So as long as we're in the medical realm, we've kind of skirted around this so far. You mentioned there was some medical pressure, in a sense, on the marriage from the start.
Yes. You know, I was 40 when we got married, despite trying to push the wedding up a couple weeks so I could still be 39. It shouldn't have surprised us, I guess, that we had some trouble getting pregnant, and we quickly moved through all the things that couples move through when they're, you know, not quickly. It was 5 years. But really, the impetus for the book was when we married, I was wishing we had 5 years just to be a couple, and instead I felt like we have to try to have a kid right away because we're too old. And then it took us 5 years plus to have a child, so what did I learn in that time? And part of what I learned was what it really means when people are trying, when they say they're trying to have a baby, and I learned the proper response is not, that's so exciting, and that it might very well be, I'm so sorry, that must be so hard, because there is a lot of emotional ups and downs involved in the quest to have a baby when you're having trouble. And, you know, we went through trying IVF, looking into egg donor, trying that, eventually adoption, and each of those steps, as much as it's wonderful to have those options, you know, you have to mentally adjust from plan A to plan B and plan B to plan C and B to D, and then of course at the end you wouldn't rather have any other child, and it's just hard to get your head around all that, even though it seems very easy from the outside and how great you have all these options. You know, they're expensive, they're emotionally trying, there's a lot of decisions about if you are going to adopt domestically or abroad or a foster child, how old the child, what you want your family to feel like and look like, and it's all very complicated, and I got a real appreciation for it, and it also really strengthened us as a couple, but it was quite a journey.
I can imagine, particularly in the early stages, because here you're trying to do something that should be natural and spontaneous, and yet after a while, when it's not working, you begin to lay some additional pressure upon it about you know, timing and temperature and all the other things that would go with that.
Yes. So I my column for O Magazine about sex and relationships, where they had a tagline on my column that said, "Have no sexual fear, Cindy Shupak is here," which I, from the beginning, was like, "Oh, do we have to say that?" I was answering reader questions and, you know, talking about how to spice up your love life, porn and lingerie, and it just quickly, I started to feel like such a fraud because our love life had become such a business of trying to have a baby that it was very hard to write about it and think about it in any other way than just as something we were doing that wasn't producing the desired results.
Did you, you've seen the movie Raising Arizona, haven't you?
Yes, I had seen it, and I loved it. I love the Coen brothers. I love Holly Hunter, and that is, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies anyway, but I rewatched it after we went through this, and it really resonated on a whole other level. Because also, the Octomom was happening when we were trying to get pregnant, so in the same way Raising Arizona, there was that couple that had, I think it was sextuplets or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Octomom had already had some kids, and then had eight more, and...
So she had 14 altogether, I guess, yeah.
And it just felt like, really, and we can't have one, and yeah, it was, I understood Raising Arizona. We didn't resort to kidnapping, but it's not something that was out of the realm of possibility.
And I wasn't suggesting that part of it. I remember
that was planned definitely, but that was definitely a last resort, but...
Not ruled completely out at any point, though, you're saying.
Never say never, I was starting to say.
Interesting things that you did, though, with each other in the time before you had kids, though, in the thought that once kids are here, we'll do this differently. For example, a couple of Jews celebrating Christmas thinking, oh, when we have kids, we'll celebrate Hanukkah, though.
Yes. Yeah, I wrote a piece for the New York Times that is in the book about that. It was quite controversial and much emailed at the time because... Really, when we first got married, I was just thumbing through the Pottery Barn catalog and thinking, this is so beautiful. This is why I wish we had Christmas. And Ian said, well, we can do it. We're consenting adults. We can have Christmas if we want. And it felt so naughty and, you know, taboo, but we did, and we loved it. He got the tree, you know, the train that went around the tree. And we thought, well, when we have kids, we won't do this because it's confusing since we're Jewish. And then, since we adopted, we actually promised the birth mother she asked if we would celebrate Christmas. Because she wasn't Jewish, and we said, okay, because we love Christmas. So now we have the excuse that she wanted us to.
You got the perfect birth mother then, didn't you?
Yes, exactly.
Some people try pets before kids, and obviously there's a bit of a pet experience that you relate here with you and Ian. What happened there?
Yes, that was a negotiation I lost early on. I thought we should wait to have a pet. Ian, when I met him, wanted to have a dog. I liked the idea of a boyfriend with a dog. When we moved in together, I wasn't sure the timing was right because we were in New York and maybe moving to L.A. and traveling. Then we were going to try to have a baby, and it felt like, let's have a baby, then have a dog. Then it took so long. Finally, Ian said, we're getting the dog. And not only are we getting the dog, we're getting St. Bernard. And I lost that negotiation. It was quite a struggle for me because the St. Bernard was almost 2 years old. We adopted her. She was a rescue, and I just felt maybe we'd made a huge mistake, literally a huge mistake.
Huge, yes. Yeah, I heard the literal part there.
But I've grew to love her, and it took us so much longer to have a baby that I'm so glad, of course, we had our St. Bernard with us during those years.
So you lost the negotiation on the dog. There must have been some negotiations you won on, though. I mean, quite a few, I would think.
Yeah, but I wanted to point out what was interesting is I lost the negotiation, and it turned out I was so glad I did in the end. So try to remember that when you lose a negotiation. I lost the negotiation about the man cave. I lose a lot of negotiations, I think. Let me think. What was one I won?
But otherwise, I mean, this book reflects a lot of happiness. I want to make that abundantly clear to our listeners that, yes, you might have lost a few negotiations, but you're really winning overall at this point, aren't you?
I totally am, yes. The negotiation, I think what I've learned is just that it's so funny now thinking of this. I'm trying to think of one example where I'm sure Ian would think of a zillion, where it feels like...
You put your foot down.
He didn't want, yeah, mm-hmm. And... I'm not sure. He's a good negotiator. He's a lawyer.
All right. That makes sense then. The subject of entertaining over a meal, this is always interesting, particularly for new couples. I mean, how much of a panic did planning a dinner party give you?
So much. I mean, was not a cook. I had, like, my chocolate chip cookies I made. Ian thinks a dinner party is the most fun when there's chaos and food and everyone's helping. He had lived in France for a while, and that's how they did it, and I used to shop at Balducci's and buy things and then put them on plates, and I didn't even try to pretend I cooked everything. I just thought that was a very nice dinner party, a lot of great prepared food. So Ian started this challenge of we were going to make these four-ingredient meals for people where they'd choose their favorite four ingredients, and we'd build a meal around it. And I, being a bit of a perfectionist, started to take that very seriously and research the recipes, and I chronicle all this in the book. But it made me into a really good cook because we just sort of took things ingredient by ingredient, and I really enjoyed entertaining that way. We had some amazing dinner parties, and but I always panicked. I mean, and I still panic whenever we're going to have people over, and especially because Ian loves trying new. Let's try something we've never made before for people, which I feel like, what? Why don't we know we can do these few things. Let's do these things. But he loves trying new things, so and it's been really fun.
So you want to stick with the tried and true, the stuff you know how to do.
You know, sometimes it seems a little safer. Just you feel like that was good, and it wasn't easy. And we made a Peking duck one. You know, like we've done some difficult things. There's no reason not to repeat those. But anyway, he likes to try. That's why he likes to ask people the four ingredients. It sort of forces you to put new things together and try new things. And it's been great. I wouldn't do it another way.
Well, it sounds like he's got a real sense of adventure, though. When you point out that he got into rappelling, or was already into rappelling. And there's always that point in a relationship when you're at least experimenting with each other's likes and interests and hobbies and all that sort of thing. So what were the things that you were doing that he had to get interested in?
You know, one thing was travel, even though it sounds funny. He really liked to travel without an agenda. And I guess one thing I've converted him over to was more planned trips, maybe a little higher end than he was doing. He was backpacking and staying in pensions and, you know, just liked meeting people as he went, and probably girlfriends as well. So that's ended. Now he's with me, and we often do have a hotel planned in advance. But we do travel well together, and we've, you know, done a lot of traveling together, but we've probably up to the planning aspect of our travel. And we still try to leave a little time to explore, but there's that. And then I think what else has he gotten from me?
Have you taken up rappelling, though? I guess is the big question.
Yeah. You know, before I met him, I was pretty adventurous, and I had jumped out of a plane. I had done skydiving on a static cord. I was pretty adventurous. So when I met him, I did go on this, like, Ma and Pa owned rope course, and we tried rappelling down a waterfall, and he was very impressed I could, and we hiked Machu Picchu, and we did a lot of things together that the hiking Machu Picchu. We did a 4-day hike where we camped, and that was a little bit pushing it for me, but I was glad I did it. And I had done bike trips. He hasn't done that with me yet, but I'm hoping he'll do that with me. But yeah, so we'd done these things, and we'd rappelled down this waterfall. And then one time we were with friends here in LA, and he locked us out of their apartment. And we were visiting them and their new baby. We were up on their roof deck, and we were out there with them, a bottle of wine, and the new baby. And we were locked out of the apartment, and Ian used his rappelling skills to rappel down the side of a building and let us in, which was really impressive, with a garden hose tied around him.
Wow.
It was very impressive, except for that he had locked us out, and also that he probably didn't need to do it because we could have just called the super.
But hey, you know, if you're going to get people annoyed at locking them out of the house, you might at least make the recovery heroic, right?
Yes, exactly.
you say in the book, in The Longest Date, that the prenup was actually a romantic thing for you. How could a prenup be romantic?
When I met him, he had quit his corporate law job. He wasn't making much, and he actually had a lot of debt. He was one of those people that kind of believed in credit cards as that's a great way to just have the money you need. And he grew up in a family where that was what you did. And I grew up in, like, you balance your checkbook, you never have a debt at all. You pay it off every month. So he had school loans and law school loans, and people around me were kind of like, you know, there's just the fear, is he marrying you for your money? And he suggested the prenup. He wanted something that just showed he would leave with the shirt on his back. And it was romantic for him to suggest it, and for him to just want to make it really clear that that wasn't why he was marrying me.
Cindy, what's the response been like on the book tour? I mean, have people come up and said, oh, my God, I have so many things to relate to here, or, gee, I hate you, your life has been perfect since Ian came along?
Yeah, no, and it hasn't been perfect. I know I'm making him sound good, but there's certainly lots of conflicts, and you know, there are issues and continue to be issues, and that's kind of what I'm trying to write about, is how you just get through those things. But no, people have I have a friend who's engaged, and she said she'd secretly, and I think a lot of women feel this, been feeling a lot of growing pains and nerves about it and what it would mean to be married, and if her life as she knew it was kind of ending, even though she was happy to be getting married, and what the child and family planning meant next. Was she ready for that? And she just was really having a lot of nerves and not feeling like she could talk about it. And she told me she read the book, and it was exactly what she needed to make her realize that life would continue to be an adventure, and it wouldn't be easy all the time, but they would get through it, and she would still be herself within the marriage. And so that was very gratifying. And then I've had a lot of women kind of whisper to me, "We're just trying egg donor." Or one woman said, "You know, there's a surrogate in New York carrying my baby. I'm having a baby alone, and I was so happy to hear your story." I think especially the fertility issues are just comforting to read and to feel not alone in that struggle, and how you deal with it with your spouse, and how you might be able to actually be more open with your friends and family than you thought about what you're going through. So that's been very gratifying. And then I think women who are married, and I've had some men and women come together to reading couples, and the men weren't sure what they were getting into, and they really have enjoyed it. And, you know, they found it kind of bonding as a couple. So that was very nice to see, too.
And I understand this has, I just was reading the promotional materials here on the table, but it's been optioned for a Fox series?
Yes, I'm working with Jake Kasdan, who exec produced and directs New Girl. He's a really great director, and he's going to direct the pilot, and I'm working on the script now and working on like a fictionalized version of the book that is takes all the best parts of the book but then has room to grow and combine experiences of other couples and you know, just changing the names of the characters so that I don't feel like, wait, we never did that. But it's been fun to work on. I'm excited that they, you know, it feels like something that's so mundane in a way, marriage, that there's so many people have been married. What do you have new to say about it? But I think something that is romantic still and yet honest and funny and, you know, true is a little bit missing in our dialogue.
And it certainly is an adventure every day. I can attest to that after 28 years of marriage. So the book is called The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. Cindy Shupak wrote it, and she's been our guest. Cindy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you. Monday on the Jefferson Exchange, we'll talk about a dam suit for the Shasta River settled. We'll talk about an anti-human trafficking group in the Grants Pass area. And then we'll meet the author of the book, What the Dog Knows, about working dogs. And yes, knows, K-N-O-W-S, although N-O-S-E comes into this play as well. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant at the controls today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here in the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, and have a great weekend.